Elliot, technically last week was Groundhog Day, but let's have the groundhog conversation around the NHL. Dramatic pause. Goalie interference.
I thought we were going to play I Got You, Babe, with this, like from Groundhog Day, the movie.
The little Sonny and Cher
reprise?
Well, that's
if you've ever seen that movie, and that is my favorite Bill Murray movie, Groundhog Day.
Hang on. Whoa. More than Caddyshack?
Okay.
Actually, you know what, though? I don't consider that to be a Bill Murray movie. That's a Rodney Dangerfield
movie.
That's
fair. Yeah. Okay, but second. Okay. Already it's dropping down. But at 6 in the morning when his alarm goes off every day in Groundhog Day, they start with, I've got you, babe.
Right. And if you're anyone in the NHL, in the executive suites, your day starts off with goaltender interference conversations. Because you get the phone calls, because you read about it online, and you hear the hue and cry about what are we going to do about this. And you write about this in 31 Thoughts this week. And one of the things that, and I've been knocking on this drum for a while too, and I'm really glad you put it in there. It's a quote from Paul Romanuk saying, like, look it, we may just be headed the double IHF standard.
I don't think anybody wants that.
I don't think anybody wants it. I know that Gary Bettman rolls his eyes when you even mention that or anything else to do with how the double IHF conducts business on the ice. And I understand that. However, one of the legitimate questions I think we do have to ask ourselves is, why do they paint the ice blue? Why do they paint the crease blue? You know, like, if it's not going to be enforced double IHF standard, why not just make it the same color as the rest of the ice?
I'm not going to argue this. For one thing, I'm not an interior designer, so I can't answer this question. I think people want an aggressive game. And it's hard enough to score as it is. And if you don't let players be aggressive around the crease, it's going to be impossible to score. But I see a different fix. Instead of going to that international rule.
Pause. So everyone knows the international rule is you cannot go in the crease.
If
you
do,
there's a whistle, it's out to the neutral zone.
Yeah. I don't think people want more whistles. I know the commissioner doesn't want more whistles. He's always looking at how long is our average game and we can't let it creep up.
Yeah.
I can't see anyone wanting that. So there's another solution, and there's a general manager, and he wasn't thrilled it got out. So he declined comment on it, and he said, why don't we do something like basically the Department of Player Safety does, but only internal. There's a goaltender interference ruling. You know, the only people who know what's being said are the people in the situation room and the referee on the headset. Put a clip of it on an email and have someone transcribe what the conversation was. At least that way we know what the standards are to some degree.
So that gets released publicly?
No, they want that private.
Isn't that part of the problem, though? Fans watch the game and they seem to throw their hands up and say, hold on a second here. I don't know from game to game, from day to day, what goalie interference is or not. I like what the Department of Player Safety does with those videos.
I agree.
That calms
a lot
of people down.
I'm mentioning it from this point of view because it was suggested to do it privately at the beginning.
Right.
But I'm with you. You know, Jeff, anything that makes the sport better and more clear and more accountable, I'm all for it. You know, I think the other thing too, though, is that I think you have to limit the amount of people who make the final call.
Yeah.
You know, Dave Jackson's retiring this year after 1,500 games as a referee. Maybe he becomes the guy. Maybe you get another former ref like a Bill McCreary, a Rob Schick. There's lots of people in the situation who are involved in these calls. Chris King, Rod Posma, Kay Whitmore. Maybe one or two of them. Just like it's George Parros and Damien and Patrick, maybe it is one guy with a group and they make the calls. Because right now, there's too many people making the call.
That to me is sanity because, and I said this from the opening hop when this came up, and there's going to be a video review for goaltender interference. I said, well, that's fine, but the referees are the ones holding the tablets and everyone has a different standard, right? And then it gets complicated by the fact that there are goaltenders and Carey Price may be the best at this. There are goaltenders who know how to put themselves deliberately in goalie interference way.
Yes.
To draw that. Now, I've only seen one diving call, I think, this year. It was Frederik Andersen that got one.
He's the only guy who's been publicly dinged for the fine.
Yeah, I think he might be the only one that I've seen. Because I'm surprised that by
Mike
now.
Mike Smith.
Did Mike Smith get knocked for it too?
He has been knocked for it before.
Yeah, I'm surprised there aren't more goals. Anyway, that's for another conversation. But the idea that all of a sudden, because there's video review, you're going to make a call that keeps everybody happy, I think, is folly. Mm-hmm. This isn't like offsides. This isn't like, okay, did the puck go in first? And, you know, sure, we have backup offsides, and that may be a whole other kettle of fish to deal with. But this is still going to be interpretation. Like, this is still where figure skating comes into hockey. Do you think this is a call? Do you think this happened? How much weight do you put on how much the player got pushed? Was he interfered? Did he get a chance to reset? This is figure skating stuff. This is interpretation of what is happening on the ice.
Interpretive dance. You know, I think the other thing, too, is one coach told me they are getting a book on which guys get on the phone with Toronto and are like, screw you, this is my call, and I'm looking at it, and you can tell me whatever you want, and I'm still making the call. And the guys who, you know, Toronto will talk to and say, are you sure you see that? And they go, oh, maybe you're right. Like, so what, the coach asked me not to say the name of the one referee, but he says that he knows that if there's one particular referee and he wants the call opposite of where that referee is, he will try to make the challenge because he knows he can be talked out of it. And that used to happen when I covered the NBA, and I broke in covering the NBA. Mm-hmm. Brendan Malone, the coach of the Raptors, he was the Raptors' first coach, he showed me his notebook and said, okay, this referee, this is what I'm getting. Right. That's when I realized how much these guys really scouted the referees back in 1995.
It's funny, too, because there's a handful that I talk to on a regular basis, officials in the NHL, and there's a lot that we hear, you know, whether speaking publicly or privately, who always sort of sing from the same hymn book. We don't care who makes the call as long as it's the right call. That seems to be the battle cry and always has been for officials around the NHL, which is why I am so surprised at how much they are pushing back on, no, we want to make the call on goaltender interference.
Because they were promised that.
We are not. But it's not working. Like, at a certain point, like, does there not need to be a concession from the Referees Association that this is interpretive, to your point, interpretive dance? We're judging aesthetics here. Is it a call or not? And if there's 20 people making the call, you're going to get 20 different standards and 20 different calls. I'm with you. It needs to go to a jury of one, not a jury of 20 every night.
You know, guys, we don't give up power very easily.
Like, it's true, but in the case of officials, they've always put out there front and center in bold letters, just get the call right.
Hey, look, I agree with you. I think it's time. I think it's silly that, you know, you've got a war room in Toronto or a situation room in Toronto with all these beautiful 4K screens, can see everything down to the tiniest pixel, and you have the referees on these iPads, and God knows how the wireless or the feed is. To me, it's craziness, but I have seen this many times before. People do not like giving up power easily. And, you know, the NHL gives its officials a very wide latitude. Other sports, if there's a controversial call, you know, one umpire will have to deal with a pool reporter.
No, that doesn't, not in the NHL.
That does not happen in the NHL. The NHL is very protective of its officials. You know what? And to me, actually, that's a bit of a shame because I think some of those guys, the ones I think a few of us talked to, they're really smart guys, and they could very easily explain, you know, the kinds of situations and things that they see that happen. But I'm with you. It's time to make a change on this. I only care about one thing. Make the game better. What makes the game better? What avoids a fiasco in the playoffs or in a huge, meaningful game? And to me, this is the best route to it.
Ralph Nader, too fast at any speed. Is the game right now, and I've maintained this, is the game right now too fast to be called properly?
I would say yes. I think you get to a point where you're playing at a certain level or you're refereeing at a certain level, you can slow the game down like the great players do. But what have we learned about the offside reviews? It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of these calls that are being overturned, they're being overturned on a sliver.
Well, we're watching the game, I mean, pixel by pixel now.
Yeah.
When we do this.
Yeah. I do think that slow motion makes a lot of innocent plays look worse.
That's absolutely true.
And there are people in the league who believe very strongly in that. That's part of the problem.
See, the challenge is, too, the players can catch up to the speed of the game and, I think, make it safer. I think when the game opened up coming out of the lockout 2005, I mean, there were some disastrous hits and some disastrous repercussions. And we're saying to ourselves, like, you know, each game has a body count. This is kind of getting a little macabre here. This is craziness as everyone tried to relearn the game. Players have adapted to that now. And it's fast, and it's a lot safer than it was back in 2005 when the new rules package came in. But your eyes are your eyes, and your eyes aren't seeing any faster.
No.
Your eyes aren't getting any quicker. I mean, they can try to adapt, but it's taking a long time. And you see it in goalie interference, and you see it with offsides. And I'll tell you what, man, if I'm an official right now and there's a 50-50 play on an offside, I'm blowing the whistle.
Well, that's what a lot of teams say is happening, right?
I'll blow that just because I don't want the video review.
You know what?
If there's a goal.
I got to tell you, if I was an official, I wouldn't be scared of that. I wouldn't. Because if I'm being overturned by the slightest lift of a player's toe, that doesn't bother me. I'm sorry, it just doesn't. As a matter of fact, I think people get more annoyed with the fact it is the sliver of the toe as the fact that the official made the call. What are people saying when those calls get overturned? They're saying that's not the spirit of the rule. They're not saying that the referee is blind and or the linesman is blind and he can't make the call. You know, I think we have to have perspective here. You know, I was watching an NBA game last night and Russell Westbrook tripped and there was a tripping penalty and he tripped over his own foot. Like, I think it can happen, and the referee, I'm sure she was disappointed when she saw it later. And in the moment, I know you feel terrible, but I think in the grand scheme of things, everybody's going to make a mistake, and it depends on the degree of your mistake. If you were just being wrong by a sliver, I don't think that should bother you.
See, now
that wouldn't bother me.
The standard is so much higher now once you introduce video review. Like, the minute video review came in, all of a sudden the standard for getting the call right is as close to 100% as it's ever been.
Yeah, but you shouldn't be afraid of that. Like, did you see Nick Foles' quotes the other day? Like, everybody fails.
Yep.
Everybody fails. There's not a person who gets through life unscathed.
I've never seen a perfect coach, a perfect hockey player, a perfect goaltender, yet the expectation for officials has always been 100%.
I think a lot of that would – I know that some of the biggest complaints between players and officials is that you don't communicate anymore, right? Like, it used to be that the referees, and especially in the NBA too, used to talk on the ice. That's gone away. I think that's a bigger issue, actually, Jeff, than anything else, is the communication lags at times. But you know what? Mistakes, yeah, we all make mistakes that are egregious ones that we wish we didn't do. But how many of them are you making? If you're making 1,000 big mistakes, you got a problem. But if you're making a bunch of small ones where only the tiniest thing on instant replay is proving you wrong, I'm sorry. I think at that speed, you got to live with that.
The problem with goalie interference is, what's a mistake?
Yes, that's something completely different.
We don't know what a mistake is on offside. We don't know what a mistake is on goalie interference.
No.
I had this conversation with Colby on TV the other day, and he's all for just getting rid of video review. Just saying, you know what?
There's a lot of people who are like
blush,
that.
First blush, make the call or don't make the call.
I don't think the league is ready to get there yet. I don't think that's what the league wants.
Did they do anything other than maybe a couple more memos and some massaging by the players?
Well, you know, like,
because that's the fear, right?
Just
that's
so I can honestly believe I'm important, I would like them to do what I wrote in the blog. But I'm not that naive to believe I'm that important. I just find most things in life, there's solutions out there. Do you want to find them or do you want to be obstructionist? There's a solution here, or not a solution, but a way to manage it better and make your chances better. Do you want to go there or do you want to find problems with that road?
Managing expectations. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Thoughts. Oh, Gary Bettman, why did we expand? You know, it used to be that one guy was able to do 30 thoughts all on his own. Now, with the addition of the Vegas Golden Knights, we've had to call in another guy to get that extra thought. Are you kidding me? Gary Bettman, please don't expand to Seattle anytime soon. If this thing goes to 32 thoughts, boy, will this show be in the tizzy.
That a boy, Sam Cosentino. Very nice. So, welcome to the podcast. Jeff Merrick alongside Elliot Friedman. Cameo by our man Sam Cosentino. You can watch him Saturdays, 3:30 Eastern, for the Saturday Showcase, our CHL Game of the Week. Also watch him on the next one.
And you tape your podcast on junior hockey the same day you tape your 31 Thoughts podcast.
Wednesday mornings, 10:30 Eastern.
So it's Wednesday a TV show. It is a podcasty day for
you. It is a podcast. It's also a TVE day and a radioe day.
Yeah.
Because the show that I do with Sam also dovetails as a television property and a radio show as well. So it's a proverbial triple threats. It wasn't that long ago, 2012, Rick Nash was the player everybody coveted at trade deadline time. Here's the question for this year, and you read about this in 31 Thoughts, first thought as a matter of fact. Rick Nash, does he make it to trade deadline, and then at the end of the season, does he go back to New York?
I'm going to answer part two first. I think there's a decent chance he goes back to New York. You know, you can't do anything now. If you make a paper trail, you know, the commissioner is going to come at you with hellfire and brimstone, so you don't do that.
Sure.
But I wouldn't be surprised if it's something that has been, you know, quietly discussed.
So hang on. So we're going to trade you, but you might not want to sell your house.
Well, I think, you know, we had Doug McLean on last week. I think he did that a couple of times.
I think with Jeff Sanderson,
yes,
perhaps.
Don't do this. But, you know, you heard how Nash talked when the reports got out that he'd done it. He said, you know, it's tough to tell my kid that,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I think he'd want to go back. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does. The New York Rangers have a chance for one of the all-time great six-month things here. They could trade Nash. They could trade Grabner. I think there's quite a bit of interest in Grabner.
Sure.
And they can trade Holden, who I think there's quite a bit of interest in, too, for D. You get all this stuff, and then you maybe bring them back. So you get what you traded for them, and then you bring them back. And the other thing, too, a wild card with New York is Ilya Kovalchuk is at the Olympics. And last year, his rights belonged to New Jersey. He's an unrestricted free agent now. And I think his preference is to come back to the New York area. And depending on what he wants, what if the Rangers end up with everything they get this year? They get one or two of those guys back, and they get Kovalchuk too.
You need stars to sell in New York. It's a competitive market. The question becomes, can he still play at that elite level in the NHL? We don't know. Some have gone there and come back and done quite well. Thank you very much. Hello, Alexander Radulov.
Yeah.
That's the obvious example. I think Mark Giordano was the first one that we all saw that went to the KHL and actually came back better.
He had a three-way deal when he first signed it. You don't even see those anymore. He had one salary at the NHL.
Yeah.
He had a second salary at the AHL and a third salary if it was in the ECHL.
Oh, did he have the three?
Yeah, you don't have those anymore. They don't exist.
He played Aksar Ben Knights, and he wanted the one-way deal. I think it was Daryl Sutter who wouldn't give it to him, and he said, fine, I'm going to the KHL. And it was at that time, too, we thought that was almost a death sentence. Like, you're going to the KHL, you're not coming back.
We'll never see you again.
You're throwing your career away, never to be seen again. He came back and was a better player. The exception, not the rule.
You're using a flip phone. Like, you don't do that.
Back to the Rangers quickly here.
Yeah.
You know, this is a situation where for so long they were in it and they were in the conversation and they were making a push to the Stanley Cup final. Got there, lost against the Los Angeles Kings, but they're always in the conversation amongst the top team in the Eastern Conference. The shady side of that, sunny side of the mountain is you didn't have high draft picks.
Yeah.
You know, Brady Shea, you know, previous to last year was their last first round draft pick. And since then, no one's, I guess, Pavel Buchnevich, who was a third-round draft pick, Anthony DeClaire, they ended up trading to Arizona. But no one's come in to knock your socks off by way of draft.
Well, they took their shot.
They did take their shot.
They took their shot.
And now
they got there once, and they were consistent. I think now they're replenishing that. They got two first-rounders last year.
Elias Anderson, Filip Hedl.
And they look like they're players. Yeah. Hedl in particular has been very impressive in the American Hockey League this year as a young kid.
Elias Anderson was the one, by the way, that chucked the medal up in the stands.
Yes. And, you know, I got to tell you, like, everybody's entitled to a bad moment, right?
Oh, I don't have any problem with it at all.
I don't have any problem with it either. I think that when he's older, he will look at that and say,
I was a kid.
And I think he'll probably appreciate the medal. Because it's so hard to get it. But I don't have a big deal. Everybody's entitled, especially if I got penalized for all the idiotic things I did when I was 19, I wouldn't be here right now. But, you know, I think the thing that's interesting to me about the Rangers is we're seeing this a lot in baseball right now. We are guilty of groupthink on long-term contracts for older people, older athletes. Like, you look at Major League Baseball right now, the market is paralyzed because the entire baseball world thinks that we do not give long-term deals to aging players.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no free agency getting done. And the players talked about boycotting spring training, but they can't do that. They were warned they can't do that. But they're angry. And you know what? Obviously, when you sign a long-term deal at an older player, you're taking a bigger chance. But that whole sport is paralyzed because everybody thinks the same. In NHL, there's some of that too. You know, like, don't sign an older player to a long-term deal. But I look at when the Rangers did it for Lundqvist, we all said the same thing. Oof, this one is big. I look at this and I say, the Rangers knew Henrik Lundqvist better than anybody else. They took their chance on a guy they knew better than anyone. And he is rewarding their faith. And I think you're suddenly looking at it like we were wondering if Henrik Lundqvist's prime was maybe one or two more years. You hoped for three or four, mm-hmm. would be thrilled with five. Well, now you're looking at it and you're saying, you know what? We still really have something here. He's having a great year. So I think you can do your rebuild and your reset at the same time.
And so are you saying then you're more in favor of signing older players to longer-term contracts, even though, you know, if you look at how the numbers break down, generally forwards peak around 26.
Yes.
And by the time someone gets to the age of 30, you don't want to be, you know, handing out seven-year
deals. I
think
every case is different. I'm a big baseball fan, okay? I love baseball.
Yeah.
And I think that analytics have been good for baseball for the most part. But I think they're starting to really hurt it. The World Series was great last year, but how many pitchers were taken out ridiculously early in games last year? Anytime you walked into trouble in the sixth inning, you're gone.
All I know is every time I turn on Jeff Blair on 590 in the summer, within 5 minutes I hear the phrase pitch count.
Yeah. And baseball has become – it used to be the old way – and people said, no, that's groupthink, and now we're doing analytics, and now they're groupthink that way. Like, the whole sport thinks the same now. And it's actually made me think about, as analytics start to become a bigger and bigger part of hockey, it's made me think, like, what if hockey gets like that where everybody thinks the same the other way? Right now, hockey is a very insular sport for one reason. What if it becomes an insular sport the other way, like baseball's become?
You know, it's funny.
I don't want to see that either.
I was thinking about this a while ago, just the nature of zone entries. Actually, you talked about this a little bit with the Michael Frolik situation in the past of Dougie Hamilton. The idea that, you know, everything has to be a carry over both blue lines.
Yeah.
Okay? And for zone entries, whether it's at the junior level, I talked to someone with the Greyhounds, top team in the CHL. Kyle Raftus, a general manager of the Greyhounds, and he's talking about, you know, how, you know, we carry the puck and it's own entries and possession and we like to have it on our sticks. And I remember this goes back a few years, even, you know, when Kyle Dubas ran the Greyhounds. So I said, well, what if everybody played that exact same way? You would be the easiest team to game plan against because you know that they're not going to surrender the puck. So there's going to be no dumps. You challenge them at the blue line. Like if everybody played the exact same way based on what the analytics dictate that you should, it'd be a pretty easy game plan. Be pretty simple because you know what the percentages are, and so you game plan against the percentages. You don't game plan against the personalities. Mm-hmm. And that might be even the bigger conversation. Does that take away the individualism of the player based on if you're going to play percentages, this is the right play here, whether you're a right winger
or
center.
I think hockey's already like that.
I think it's getting there.
Yeah, I think the coaches are very risk averse.
I think they're nervous about the numbers, though, too.
Yeah.
Just because analytics in hockey is still very much in its infancy, unlike baseball, where the early adopters and have taken it, as I understand it, to a whole different level. Soccer's like this as well, for my friends that follow soccer, and everything is, this percentage says this, so this is what you do.
And you know what? Like, when Moneyball first came out, and it was a revolutionary book, it was Billy Beane was the one guy who thought differently, right? Now everybody thinks like him. So are we going to go back to the old way so somebody can think differently?
Mm-hmm.
World Series was awesome last year, but last year was the most boring season of baseball I ever watched because everybody's the same. So I'm watching the analytics start to rise in hockey and some things that people are trying to do and look at and inefficiencies. And I'm like, what if this happens in hockey that everybody's the same? And I'm like, this is the worst. So like, I was like everybody else. When the Rangers signed Lundqvist, I was thinking, oh, 8-year deal at his age, that's going to be a tough one. And now I'm watching this guy, and he's still great.
Mm-hmm.
For a while there, we were a bit worried, but he's still great, and he's playing phenomenal this year. I'm thinking, is there a better way we should be looking at this? We don't have all the data that the Rangers have. We don't know Henrik Lundqvist like the Rangers know him.
Yeah.
And we don't take that into account enough.
But how well do we know the body? We know the numbers, but do we know the body?
Well, sports science, all these teams are big now into sports science.
But that's my question, right?
Yes.
Like, how well do you know, is his hip firing still at 100%? Because especially when you're talking about a goaltender,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the wear and tear, not just what you see in the games, right? You know, like what's the old the Buddha saying? The bullseye is the result of 100 misses. Like we don't see what happens in practice, right?
Yeah.
Up and down and up and down. That's cool when you're 22. That's great. That's rock and roll. You start to get into your 30s, and you got a body of work that you're up and you're down, your hips and your groin and like all of it. You're more prone for that injury where suddenly it's
absolutely
over in your 30s.
But you know better than anybody else.
You are in your early 20s.
But you know better than anybody else, and that's why a lot of the players or not so much a lot of the players, but the players' associations against player tracking.
Sam Cosentino and I were at the Combine a couple of years ago. We had Matt Nichol there with us in Buffalo. And Sam and I were talking to him about, you know, what can you really glean from the Combine, from what they're doing, right? Like, how is this translatable right away into what the player is going to do in the NHL? And Matty said something really interesting. He said, I am really curious in situations like this to find out more about a player's body, where his areas of weakness are, and where he might be injury prone, where that's going to show up somewhere, because you're investing millions and millions of dollars. For what Matt Nichol does, who's a strength and conditioning coach, he's the curator of BioSteel, he said, the big thing of interest to me is where I see a body already starting to break down early in someone's career. Because you can probably surf on that for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
But then you start to get a little bit older, and then you have to project out, okay, if we're going to invest a first-round pick in this guy, we suspect by the age of 27, this area of the body is going to break down. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, that's sports science. I agree with you. And that's what the players, at least the association, is scared of the most, because that's going to cost guys careers. By the way, just before we go, because we've been talking too long, you know what the one thing I learned?
What's up?
At the testing day, Kelly Rudy said that he had the best VO2 score that year. I have seen him run from the studio to the bar. I believe that 100%.
Nashville's Kyle Turris joins us next.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
Through the middle of the ice, Turris into the zone. Turris, his shot blocked. Gets his own rebound, cuts in, scores! Kyle Turris wins the game!
I said at the start of overtime that the feast of Kyle Turris was well present.
Here's Carlson. Lays the puck ahead. Turris inside the zone. Gets a shot away. Scores! A laser beam from Kyle Turris.
Holy smokes. He just wound up and Marc Messier back foot up in the air. Stings this one.
We're obviously sad to see Turris go. He's someone who's been a part of this organization for a long time and put in a lot of work and effort into to getting to where we are today. And not only as a player, but as a, you know, community leader as well. I think that him and his family did a lot of good things for everything, you know, that involves the city of Ottawa. So in that aspect, I think that, you know, it's something that we probably would have wished would have been a little bit different, but it is what it is. And
Nashville from the get-go has always been interested in acquiring Kyle Turris. David and I talked all through September, all the way leading up to the start of the season, and I said if Kyle hadn't been traded by then, that we'd probably end up keeping him for the year.
Since the franchise started 20 years ago, our skill and depth at the center position has always been something that we've coveted and continually searched for. With the acquisition of Kyle Turris, we are now as skilled and as deep at the center position as we ever have been.
Turris scores!
His first game as a Predator. He has lit the lamp to tie the game. What a goal. Look at the entry here. Kyle Turris scores in his first game as a Nashville Predator.
You saw that big smile. That's the Hermitage Lighting Gallery first goal of the game. Kyle Turris making his entrance. But not a bad way to put the gold jersey on.
Oh, get some great high fives by the guys coming back to the bench. Awesome.
Pleased to be joined now by Kyle Turris, forward for the Nashville Predators. First of all, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for coming in live. Always appreciate that. I know it's a busy time for you, kind of put you through the interview process upstairs as, you know, on the horizon. Big things for you, big things for the Nashville Predators. First thing I want to ask you, we hear so much about, oh, I got to adjust to the system, going to a new team. How different is it going from the Eastern Conference to the Western Conference, and how different is it playing for Guy Boucher than Peter Laviolette?
The conferences are very different. That's one thing that I remembered from playing in Phoenix, yep, going to Ottawa, and then going back to Nashville. It is a very different feel. Bit of a bigger, heavier game in the West and a little bit more speed maybe in the East. But yeah, it's something to adapt to and to adjust to, and I'm still working on that right now.
It's interesting. For the longest time, defensemen that would go from the Eastern Conference to the Western Conference would always talk about how quicker they had to make a decision. How they had a little more time, a little more space in the East. And a lot of those, Grossman and Sakara and Hamilton, would struggle a little bit when they first went over there. It took a while to adapt. How quickly could you pick up Western Conference play?
It takes some time in all aspects of the game, I find. Like you said, in decision making, I feel like for defensemen, there's a lot of zone time, down low, cycling in the West, a little more off the rush in the East. And I mean, for me, another thing that you might not think about is face-offs. Face-offs are slightly different as well. It's in the West, it's a lot more of just kind of a heavy sweep. And in the East, there's more kind of stick work and kind of, I don't know how to explain it. It's just a bit different.
I've never heard, Friedge, have you heard that before?
No, it's
I've
good to
never
know
heard
if you're in
that.
The West, you only need one move.
There no, that's not what I'm trying to say. It's,
no wonder Drysdale's so good. He's got that huge paddle on the end of his,
no,
end of his
it's,
stick.
Yeah, it's just another thing to adapt to and something I got to get used to.
I have to tell you, Kyle, I knew things were serious this year. I don't check my Twitter followers a lot. But one day I looked up and one of my new followers was Julie Turris. And I knew big things were going on.
Yeah.
It's been a whirlwind for you this year. What are the biggest things you think of?
Oh, man. The trade happening and not shock, but just adjustment of that. Getting settled in Nashville, getting comfortable. The organization made it a very easy transition. Thankful for that. And the guys on the team have been amazing. They made me feel comfortable right away. So, yeah, getting the family down, getting set up, finding a house, getting the kids into school, you know, getting our nanny down, getting into a routine. I mean, that's just in the past 3 months. But we had a newborn son in the end of August. And, I mean, the playoff run we had last year with Ottawa, it's been a crazy year.
You know, you knew there was a possibility, and there's a player I text with now, and he said the toughest thing is the uncertainty on you and your family, and he's like you. He's got a wife and young kids, and he's like, I wish it was over already. What was that like for you and your family as you went through all that?
It's a tough situation because it's, like you said, it's a lot bigger than hockey in terms of, you know, my wife and my three kids and their lives and routines of school and friends and family and all that hinges on hockey. So it's very important things that hinge on my job. And yeah, it's tough to drag it out. And like you said, there's the uncertainty of staying in Ottawa, or if I didn't stay in Ottawa, where they're going to send me. And it's just a very difficult situation.
Did you have an idea of where it might be?
I mean, there's rumors going around.
Sure.
And, I didn't know for sure. No.
Was it more difficult to detach yourself from the team or from the community?
Both. I had really good friends on the team, Carl and Stoney and Boro and, you know, a bunch of the guys. It was a really good group there. So I had really good friends there. And then the neighborhood we lived in, we had such good friends and we were lucky to have such good neighbors. And then they were all going through the same stages as us. They had kids similar ages that we played with, and then working with the Capital City Condors the relationship we built with the Perkins family and all the kids on the Condors. It was tough. Yeah, it was definitely tough to leave.
I've asked a couple of different Ottawa Senators this question and gotten different answers. Curious about this. We've made a lot about, in the Boston series, the Carlson pass to Hoffman. Now, I maintain, and maybe as a forward you'll agree with me, I maintain it was a harder pass to take than make. Where are you on that one? Is that a harder pass to make or a harder pass to take?
I think to make.
Yeah?
I think,
Jeff, I don't even understand that. How can anybody argue otherwise?
Hoffman doesn't break stride. It's perfect. He doesn't break stride, then he comes in and does that Forsberg Nielsen play.
It lands
flat. You know,
flat.
He makes a great play, but if that pass was so easy, everybody would do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming from, I don't know, 100 feet, 120 feet down the ice, literally 15 feet in the air, lands flat on your tape.
Yeah.
That's a pretty easy one to take. Be harder if you had to slow down or stop or turn, or if it bounced 2 feet in front of him. But, I mean, Carl put it flat on his tape.
Sends him the lead pass, hopping along. Scores! All that action inside the Ottawa line and then the long clearing pass. And it's 1-0 Ottawa.
And then what a play here by Carlson. Right over top, high over the forwards, right on the tape. I mean, on the tape of Hoffman, who's been quiet in this series. And he does the old hockey school move. He'll up back with the one hand, completely fools Tuukka Rask.
What did you think when you saw that? What are the whole bench? I mean, I can only imagine.
You're just in awe. Because if I remember right, Carl's kind of in a bit of a one-on-one battle behind the net, going back and forth, strips the guy, gets the puck, and without even looking up too much, he knew Hoff was flying, and I mean, it's just the flick of the wrist. I mean, it's not like he wound up or anything. He just kind of flicked it, and unbelievable. I mean, that's Carl, though. He's just a freak of nature. He's special.
You know, we mentioned the Capital City Condors, and I just wanted to, one of the most beautiful stories that I saw last year was you played a playoff game and you went right to their banquet, as you promised, right after that game. Do you keep in touch?
Yeah. I talk to Jim, you know, every couple of days. Jim Perkins is the founder of the Condors, him and his wife, Shanna. Mm-hmm. I talk to him every couple of days, and I've kept in touch with some of the families on the Condors, and I can't wait to see them all after the game on Thursday.
Oh, so they're gonna be there after the game. How many people are you hosting?
There's gonna be a bunch of Condors and parents, and the Perkins will be there, and yeah, it's gonna be really neat.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with this, this means that Kyle is playing against the Ottawa Senators on Thursday night for free. You've bought so many tickets that night that is salary, but that is a great thing if you're gonna do it.
Yeah,
Kyle. That's one of the best stories I've ever seen. I really thought it was fantastic.
My wife and I were kind of, we didn't see what was so special about it because, I mean, we were win or lose. I mean, we were going to go to the banquet and it's something we were excited to be a part of, and just happened that they'd planned it on the night that we were playing. So we were hoping to catch the tail end of it after our game. And I mean, it just worked out lucky that I scored and we won. But I mean, I don't know. We got a lot of props for it, but we were going anyways. Mm-hmm. We didn't really understand what was the big thing about it.
Well, it's just the fact you did it. Like, that's what it is. I can see your sheepish. You don't want to talk about it. I'll move on. You have said you want to take the high road going into Ottawa. I just want to ask you this. Last year, that team was a goal away from going to the Stanley Cup final. Mm-hmm. What happened?
What happened in what regard?
Like, just this year. Like, it went totally sideways. And I don't think any of us saw it coming.
Yeah. I'm not sure, to be honest. I mean, good group of guys. Good team. Like you said, we're a goal away from a Stanley Cup, and I feel like that's kind of hockey today, you know? Tough decisions have to be made in terms of signing guys, trading guys, and I think that organization's going to be having to make a bunch of those decisions, starting with me and moving forward with big guys they have coming up.
Well, you're in a great spot. That's the understatement of the day. Playing with Nashville right now, I mean, it's a team that's, you know, you're flip-flopping back and forth, tops in, you know, probably the best division in all of hockey with the Winnipeg Jets right now. What's it like day-to-day with the Nashville Predators? What's that room like?
It's exciting. It's a lot of fun. We have a really good group. When I came here, I knew it was a really young group. Obviously, I knew how good they were with the success they had last year. But the one thing I didn't expect was how mature of a group they were for their age.
Yeah.
You know, all these guys, Forsberg, Ellis, Josie, you know, all these young guys they have, but they're so mature. And we have a really fun, joking, light atmosphere every day showing up to the rink.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes time, we know that it's time to bear down. It's time to work. So it's a perfect balance.
I really need to thank Nashville because Nashville has given me a lot of hockey hipster cred. A couple of years ago, someone gave me the tip about Victor Arvin, said, hey, start talking about this guy because he's legit, then wearing 38, call him the Great 38. And I got a lot of hipster cred by being one of the first to get on that train. Then I got on the Matthias Ekholm train. and who I think was fantastic and has been fantastic for you guys for a long time. If I want to continue my hockey hipster streak through Nashville, who should I pay attention to now that no one's talking about?
Gosh, there's Kevin Fiala.
I was expecting you to say Fiala, so there it goes. Okay.
He's got a bit of both. He's obviously a very exciting player on the ice, tons of skill, very creative. And off the ice, he's got some pretty good style too.
There's always a guy you go to a team with and you say, man, before I knew this guy, I thought he was a real jackass. And then you meet him and you feel only slightly less that that's the case. Who is that guy?
I don't know if there is that guy on Nashville. No.
No?
Like Subs and I had our battles with Montreal and Ottawa. But I never thought he was an ass or anything. I thought he was funny, and just playing with him now, he's a great guy. He's outgoing, and he's a guy that brings everybody together in the locker room to keep it light.
How much did they talk about the Stanley Cup final last year?
Every now and then.
What do they say?
Just that it's a motivator. You know, it's something that we were that close, and we want to build off of. Yeah, it's something that we have a great opportunity here for this year and the next number of years, and something we have to take advantage of.
Kyle, on this podcast, Elliot is in charge of asking the smart questions, and I'm in charge of asking the frivolous ones. To that end, Mark Savard was on a couple of weeks ago, and we got on this thing about stick tape, and he's fanatical about his stick tape. He's actually doing YouTube videos now about how he tapes his stick and how Gretzky taped, and here's how Panarin tapes it, etc.
True or false, you would take guys' hockey sticks and retape it for them?
That is true. Yes, I would. And I just don't like to see any crevices, any like bumps on it. When you trim the toe of the tape, like I like to cut with scissors around the toe, go right to the toe, and if any little piece is kind of showing or it's crumpled, I would really take my tape right off my stick.
So I'm holding up a picture here of you about to take a face off. And Elliot, I'm not sure if you can see Kyle's stick here, but there's one piece of tape just around the toe, four strips on the blade, and then a little on top, and then you wax the tape. Can you explain this? What is that around the toe, and what's with the four little strips?
So it started when I was a kid. When Synergies came out,
yep.
Obviously they're a real expensive stick.
Mm-hmm. What color did you have?
The first one out was the gray one,
yep.
With the yellow writing, I believe.
Yep.
And my parents would get me a stick, and I wouldn't break them, but they would always fray at the toe,
mm-hmm.
Which would lead to it just slowly kind of becoming a dead stick. Like it wouldn't have the pop that it normally would. So my dad kind of came up with this idea that he'd put this one strip of tape around the toe to keep it from fraying every time I went out on the ice, and then he'd tape the whole blade. And as I kind of came into my own and went to college and off to the NHL, I actually became so used to having the tape on the toe that I would notice when I didn't have it, like the puck would slide off the toe. I wouldn't have the grip on the toe.
Mm.
But I also like the feel of kind of having a little bit of tape in the middle, but having there be a gap between the toe and the tape in the middle so I could feel the puck more just on the blade of the stick. So that's kind of the gap between the toe and the tape.
So you can feel it more in between? I always thought that the wax tape would sort
yeah,
of help
so,
the grip.
I mean, it helps the grip, but I feel like I shoot it off of where there isn't much tape. Like I toe my shot, then I let it go off the toe on my snapshot.
Where there's no tape.
Where there's not much tape, yeah.
See, I don't think that's frivolous at all. I like hearing guys talk about
their
craft.
I love stuff like this. Honestly, I could do 15 minutes just talking about tape around the NHL with Kyle here, but I know we have to move on to other things. But that is a fascinating. Now, one more thing following up on the synergy. There was always the divide. You know, it's the Modano pattern, Sakic pattern, defenseman Lidstrom. What was your pattern?
I always used the Yzerman.
The Yzerman?
Growing up. And then I believe they stopped making it, and I went to the Sakic.
I just got one more for you, Kyle. You know, I've done a lot of stories on you over the years. And, you know, one of the first ones was obviously when you decided you wanted to move on from Arizona to Ottawa and now everything that happened this year. You know, you've always been an understated guy. And it's one of the things I like about people, people who are calm but firm, people who say, I'm kind, but I'm not weak. I wonder if you have felt over the years that people have misunderstood your kindness for weakness at times, because when you've needed to be strong in your career with your professional decisions, you have been very strong, and I've always really admired that and been interested in that about you.
Thank you. It's tough at times because, you know, it's not just me, it's also, you know, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time in Phoenix, and my parents seeing kind of the stress and the career being in jeopardy with what kind of happened in Phoenix. And I've always been confident in my abilities and what I can help a team with. And I just was hoping to have that opportunity to show that. And I can never thank Brian Murray enough for the opportunity he gave me in Ottawa to grow into the player I became, and now Mr. Poile giving me that opportunity here in Nashville. So I'm very lucky and very thankful with how things worked out and how my career has gone, and I'm still trying to improve and get better.
Last one for me, and listen, thanks for spending so much time with us today. Let me give you a scenario. Do you have an office in your house? Or an office area where you keep all of your things, personal belongings, hockey paraphernalia you've collected over the years?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I told you this, all right, Kyle, you have to move right now. Get out of the house. You can I know. You can only take one thing out of your office, and that's it. What's that one thing that Kyle Turris takes? Leaves everything else behind because he can only take one thing. What would that be? So one thing that's particularly special to you, memorable, you can't live without.
That's tough.
Your first synergy.
Yeah. I've got a few things. I've got my dad's last professional lacrosse jersey for the Coquitlam Madnecks he wore.
Nice.
Framed. I think that's a cool one. I've been lucky. I've got a Clayton Kershaw signed jersey. I've got a David Ortiz signed jersey. Some cool ones like Justin Morneau, newest Minster boy.
I've got
a signed Morneau jersey. And there's other things that away from sports that are kind of the, like I've got some Condors artwork that is really neat and really special. So, I mean, hopefully that that room would never
burn down. All right,
take it all. Because we'd have to take it all with us. So.
You're a class act, a stand-up guy, and an outstanding hockey player. Thanks so much for stopping by the podcast today.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Sportsnet.ca is the home of hockey. Breakaways and breaking trades. Catch highlights, news, and expert analysis from the best in the business. Featuring award-winning authors and must-read weekly features like Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts and Quick Shifts by Luke Fox. From the morning skate to the opening face-off, Canada's deepest roster of sports writers all in one place. Visit Sportsnet.ca, the home of hockey.
You know, Elliot, it was interesting when I put up on Twitter yesterday and put up that picture of you, me, and Kyle Turris, the amount of Ottawa Senators fans who tweeted back right away, almost with a groan, like, oh, we miss him so much here. And I can't help but thinking, as, you know, talking to him, it's not just the player, but it's the person as well. Understated, BC, laid-back dude, heart in the right place, all of it.
Polite but firm.
Right? And it was a really, you know, beloved member, not just of the team, but of the community.
Well, that's what does it, right? You know, people can say, is it about the fact that they're have had a losing record since he's been gone? He was a big part of the team. I always think if you make an impact in the community, that takes you to another level, to another stratosphere. And Kyle Turris was that guy. You know, last year when he went to that event right after their game in the playoffs, that took him to another level. That was a guy who made a difference. And I'm not surprised. Between, unfortunately, the way their record's been and the way he's remembered for doing things like that, I am not surprised at all.
Where are you at on Nashville right now? Preseason, last year I had him in the final against Tampa. This year I've gotten the final against Tampa as well.
I think they're a great team. To me, they're the best team in the West. With apologies to Vegas and everybody else.
Winnipeg.
To me, they're the best team in the Western Conference. With everybody healthy, which never happens, but with everybody healthy, they're the team I would take.
You know, beginning of the podcast, we talked about Rick Nash. Is that a fit there, bumping everyone, think of, you know, Scotty Hartnell, down a peg on that left side?
I think that's one of numerous places where it could be a fit.
Yeah.
You know, he's tortured Peter Laviolette internationally before. I'm sure Laviolette wouldn't mind having him with him as opposed to against him for a change.
I mean, is that the obvious place if you're David Poile that you're looking for help on the left side?
I think so. You know, unless you think you need another center, but Fisher's coming back, so I'm not sure you need to do that. You already have three solid centers.
Who can play
centers playing the wings. I think that's the most logical thing.
Nashville's a fascinating squad because even if they don't do anything come trade deadline time,
they're really, really good.
Really good. And if they want to really push it and go for it, you know, there's two elite level prospects they have. One in Dante Fabro, who's a defenseman. That's the reason they could trade Samuel Girard. And the other is Ellie Tolvanen, who somehow fell into their laps.
Yeah.
Who, you know, with all due respect to Owen Tippett, probably had the best release of anybody in the draft last year. So they have two real blue chip guys to play with. You know, they don't want to let go of them, but there's still more coming for the Nashville. And you know what? You look at all the big guys. Like, this isn't like, okay, well, our window is this year, or we have a 2-year window on this.
They find guys.
And they lock them up.
And they lock them up.
Like, you look at the number that I know Ryan Ellis is going to be doing in a couple of years, but look at Roman Josi. Look at Matthias Ekholm.
He's coming up, too.
These guys are all still under good numbers.
Yeah.
You know, P.K. Subban.
It's like Clockwork Orange. They go in there. They're like, okay, I'm going to ask for this much. And they come out after the, being under the David Poyle Clockwork Orange brainwashing machine. They take big term with less money.
They prop up their eyeballs with toothpicks.
Except for Johansson. He wasn't doing that.
No, he got a nice ticket. Thank you very much. One of the things we want to do on this podcast, Elliot, is introduce people to some of the people that exist around the National Hockey League and around hockey that normally you don't get a chance to hear from or understand what they do. Director of Communications is a pretty unique title and can be kind of a catch-all for a lot of people as well. We had a chance yesterday to talk to Kevin Wilson, who's the Director of Communications for the Nashville Predators. Here's Kevin Wilson. Kevin Wilson joins us now, Elliot. He is the Director of Communications for the Nashville Predators, an organization that, by the way, I've always had an affinity for, going back to when they first came into the NHL. One of the things that's always impressed me about Nashville, Kevin, your thoughts on this one. It's always been a forward-thinking franchise from my point of view. End of the lockout, 2005. Salary cap comes into the NHL. Two teams right away, salary disclosure for all of their players, all new contracts, Carolina and Nashville. From your point of view, how forward-thinking is this organization today in comparison to other organizations around the NHL? How much time do you spend thinking we need to be one step ahead of everybody else?
For us, it's catering to our fans and catering to our fan base. And Nashville is different. We pride ourselves on being a non-traditional market, being transparent. Like you said, trying to be forward-thinking. We have meetings throughout our organization that's the future of sports. What can we do to get ahead on things? And whether, you know, from a media relations standpoint, it's salary disclosure, it's having non-traditional media members, aka bloggers or online media in the press box, working with everybody else. We've always been in a situation where we do play second fiddle to other sports, where we're in an area where football is king and college football is rules the roost. So anything we can do to kind of appeal a little bit more, we're always going to try to jump at it.
I remember talking to someone in Nashville after the 205 lockout, and I said, well, this is unique and certainly refreshing. And he said to me, look, you know, to your point, we're in a non-traditional fan base. We need to tell our fans exactly how we put this team together. It's important for them to know, to your point about transparency, where we are allotting our dollars, because we don't have, as much as there's a cap now, we don't have as much disposable as other teams, the Rangers, the Leafs, and the Flyers, et cetera. We don't have the resources they do, so our fans need to know where every dollar is going.
Maybe a little bit of that. It's more of saying, hey, you know, we have a budget. This is what we're going to hit. This is, you're a season ticket holder. You have the right to know exactly where your money is going. Mm-hmm. And fortunately now we've gotten to a point where we've built from having a budget of being bottom 10 teams in the league in salary to now pushing the cap and seeing how we can add a potentially a $6 or $7 million player at the deadline and stay under the cap, which is just a phenomenal place to be. I joined the franchise in July of 2007. It was the same week that there was the rally to keep the team in Nashville.
Right.
After Jim Balsillie had come in and tried to buy the team and go to Hamilton. So going from that week in July of 2007, where for all I knew, if I wanted to stay with the franchise, I was going to have to pack my bags and move to Hamilton. Not anything against Hamilton. But to being where we are now, and just seeing how the sport and how the team is just flourishing, It's been quite the accomplishment and quite the turnaround. And we really owe it to the local ownership group that stepped up, David Poyle, who's put this team together, and then Sean Henry, who's our CEO, who's just a visionary as far as the business side of things in our industry.
So when you started that week, how much did you hate the Canadian media?
We've come a long ways together, Elliot. We've come a long ways.
You know, I say that you're laughing, but
I remember it specifically. No, but I was one of the ones that had to rush out to that press conference.
Like, so I started working Hockey Night in Canada in 2003, and I went to cover I went to do a story on one of the expansion teams once, and one of the people who worked for the team said, "We hated the Canadian media for a long time because we felt like all your stories about us were terrible. You looked down on us, and you always thought we were going to move."
Well, and the reality is there was a lot of that in the perception. I mean, really, in the last handful of years, having a consecutive sellout streak that's not 86 games, knowing we're going to surpass 100 by the end of the year, the All-Star game, having the All-Star game and just – seeing what we were able to accomplish through that. And then obviously with the run to the Cup final, some of your colleagues that have been covering the game longer than I've been alive come to Nashville and see their first games in the Cup final. So, you know, a lot of that was people had this preconceived notion of hockey in Nashville, but their eyes weren't really opened up to it until they actually came and experienced all that it was.
Have you noticed a change? Have you noticed a change in the way you guys are perceived?
100%. Especially since that All-Star year. That was really the thing that really started shifting things.
Okay. Now, one of the things I'm interested in is, Jeff, explain what your title is. So you deal with us a lot. So we know what you do. For people out there who don't know you, what do you do? How would you describe your job?
I would say it's kind of twofold. It's strategic communication and marketing work close together. So a lot of our messaging across the organization is coming from our department, whether that's the business side of things or the hockey side of things. And then also being the conduit or the go-between the media and the players. And a lot of times that's a much more complex position to be in than, I guess, what it seems. We always want to do what's best for the franchise. Sometimes the media, sometimes the players don't think what we have in mind is the same. So it's relationship building. It's bringing the two of those groups together for what we hope is the greater good of the Nashville Predators.
So let's go through some scenarios that you would go through on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis. The Nashville Predators make a trade. New player is coming in. Let's just say it's Kyle Turris. What's the first thing you do?
First thing after consulting with both business and hockey operations on, you know, what our strategic planning is as far as getting this information out from the press conference to the press release to the bullet points and messaging that everyone is going to be using about why we're doing this or how we're doing this, etc. Once we get all those in place, it's to call the player and see where the player's at, because quite frankly, that's going to be a big part of it. Is once we put them in front of the media, what are they going to say? How do they feel about it? Luckily, you know, especially guys like Kyle, in the last handful of years, as that perception has changed, it's known as a great place to come and play. Guys are excited to come here, and that makes our job easy when dealing with the players. With the fans, you know, you're able to add an acquisition like that. Public opinion is going to be pretty easy to win over.
What happens when that trade leaks out before it's official?
Which,
like the Turris one did.
And quite frankly, we're in a place now where we aren't going to put anything public from a team perspective until that trade call takes place.
Yes.
Until we know without a shadow of a doubt that the player is coming this way. In saying that, our insiders like Elliot here are most likely going to break those trades before. So you do what you can to get yourself prepared as much as you can, knowing that the reality is there's only so many things a team that can control break news on, etc., trades are usually not one of them. Now, in this day and age, with as many working parts as there are.
You know, I'm always curious. There's some guys in your position, I don't think the team gives them any clue they're up to something. And then all of a sudden, the GM will drop it on his media relations person, get this release ready, this trade is done. And they're like, oh, my God, and they're scrambling. How much does David Poile let you know what he's up to? How much lead time do you have?
I think David, for being, you know, he's approaching 13, 19 wins, which will tie Glenn Sather for the most wins by a GM. He's been in the league for 36 consecutive seasons now. That's the longest consecutive seasons of any GM in the league. So he's been around. You could say, okay, we understand that he's set in his ways, that he's very old school mentality, but I feel like David is phenomenal in his communication and the way he's evolved and the way he gets the business side of things and the communication side of things and the marketing side of things. I mean, I don't think any GM would acquire PK Subban that didn't think those things. So David, while traditionally known as being close to the vest, and for the most part, I'm not going to hear about his conversations with other GMs, but I would say I'm on a need-to-know basis, and when I need to know something, I learn it in enough leeway to put a plan in place to where we can effectively do our jobs and roll out a communication plan with that. So I don't think that it needs to be any other way. Mm-hmm. He feels the comfort of having his privacy with talks and stuff, but I get enough information to do my job effectively when it comes down to it.
What's the angriest you've ever seen him?
Angriest I've ever seen David.
Yeah.
Honestly, after Shea Weber injured his knee against Chicago in the 2015 playoffs.
And that was the series that was like double overtime, triple overtime.
Yes.
Like that was a hard
yes.
series.
We lost Mike Fisher. We lost Shea Weber.
I thought you were going to say Shea Weber offer sheet. You started down Shea Weber.
I wasn't standing right next to him after that. And David has been through so many playoff series, and he's a guy that deserves the success of a run to the Cup final and hopefully a run to two more games beyond what we had last year in 2018.
The media has changed a lot. You were one of the – you and Washington were among the first to allow bloggers in your press box. We are in a changing world. From the way you have to deal with the people who are covering hockey and the way hockey's covered, what are the biggest changes you've seen?
Probably the desire for just instant information. The fact that even from our beat writer's perspective, that game story is not as important as the tweets that might go out after the game. Mm-hmm. The media world is moving so fast, it's on to other things because no one is necessarily reading a game story the next morning. Because I'm, I guess, a little bit more old school in how I consume things, that I like clicking on the website and reading a game story and seeing quotes and reaction and stuff and kind of getting my personal feelings separated from professionally how the industry's moving, I think is probably the biggest challenge for me.
Okay. You mentioned you traded for PK a couple of years ago. He's a one-man marketing machine. I don't know if challenge is the right word or the difference in being a media relations person around PK as opposed to any other player.
There's nothing like it that I've seen before. PK has a WME marketing group that Jill Smoller that represents him. She does Serena Williams as well. Rob Gronkowski did Kevin Garnett, Pete Sampras. He's really created an enterprise. And we, because we, I feel like we work so well with them, we're able to promote and get him on The Daily Show to promote Blue Line Buddies, which is his program that's just been phenomenal between police and underprivileged kids in Nashville, while letting someone else handle his Adidas deal or his Scotiabank deal. Mm-hmm. So because he's kind of created this enterprise, yeah, there's a lot of media requests that come through for him, but because he's got everybody communicating but in kind of separate pockets, it makes it very manageable.
Here's my last one to you. So Kevin and I, Jeff, have a good working relationship. But I think
according to you,
we'll find out if he agrees or disagrees. But there are going to be times where you and I are, I would say, adversarial, but you may not like something I say or you may not like something I do.
Happened just a couple months
ago. Well, so, and this is the story. So it was breaking with the Turris trade. And for those of you who don't remember, it kind of got out on Friday night. And then the actual trade itself happened on Sunday when it looked like it was dead and it kind of got revitalized. But I put a name out there, Ekholm, which wasn't in there. And you were mad, and David was mad, and we sorted it out, but you guys were mad at me, which is fine. It happens, and I was wrong in the case. How do you deal with that? Because confrontation isn't always easy, and you know you've got to keep a working relationship with people, but sometimes you get mad at them. So what is the strategy in handling that?
Well, I think every situation is different, right? I mean, I feel like we go back several years mm-hmm. of dealing with things and talking through things. And I think you know me and how I operate, and I know you and consider you someone of integrity who works as ethically and is on the straight and narrow as possible. And having that, it all comes down to relationships and having that relationship and being able to talk things out. Because mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of insiders or people privy to insider information that aren't necessarily as easy to work with or someone that I respect as much as you. So
don't lay it on too thick.
So I say all that to say that I think our situation is a bit unique because we have a great working relationship, and I can't really off the top of my head think of others that have come up that have been a knock 'em out, drag 'em out type of conflict because they're not forming the relationships to actually get the information.
Mm-hmm. I found, and Kevin, you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, I think it's gotten tougher in the digital age. Because as you said, the thirst for faster information is greater than ever. And, you know, I always had a process. I always like to let people know when I'm working on something that something's coming out. And you can't always do that anymore.
Sure.
Especially if you're worried that it's going to get lost, Jeff, and someone's going to beat you to it. And so I find that I get into more, I don't know if disagreements is the right word, spats. Sometimes it bothers me that you can't do the process the way you used to be able to do it. I'm working on this. I've got a bit of time. I can let people know, here's what I got, just so you have a heads up. And I think in this age, the Twitter age, the digital age, it's harder to do that. And it does bother me sometimes I can't do it that way.
And especially because, like you said, you want to go through things the right way. Well, what's to say someone else can't do the same thing and not have the accountability because things are moving on so fast that you can throw something out there, be wrong about it, but not really have any repercussions that someone that holds themselves to a higher standard would.
Okay, we'll end on this one then. So you've told us the angriest you've seen David was the Elliott Turris situation, the angriest David has seen you.
Oh, man. I've softened with years, so probably not. I'm sure there's been times early in my career when I took things a bit too seriously that he saw me a bit angrier.
Different times. And you've been generous with your time.
Thanks Kevin.
Thanks so much for doing this,
Kevin. Yeah, thanks,
guys,
for having me. Appreciate it.
Elliot, we all have them. Teams that we like dealing with and are easy to deal with, and teams that we don't, that are notoriously difficult. And sometimes that changes season to season. And sometimes that changes from the beginning of your career to the end of your career. I've always done well by Nashville. From day one, they've always been fantastic to deal with. And I know I've gushed about them a number of different times on various outlets. But they've always been real simple to deal with for me.
You know, it's funny because one of the questions we asked in the interview was, how much do you hate the Canadian media?
Yeah.
And they really hated us for a while. But since I've been at Hockey Night, whenever we called them for something, they were great. I agree with you. I think it's interesting when you're quote-unquote national. You know, you're not there every day, so I think they're happier to see you mm-hmm. sometimes. Oh, these guys are calling us. Like, we haven't heard from them in a while. We're happy to help out. But I think they also worry about if the story turns out to be negative or something goes off the rails in a way you don't expect, the damage can be greater. So I think at the end of the day, like with most people in life, you try to treat people fairly and you hope it goes in the right direction.
Who's your favorite to deal with?
I don't know if I want to give any of these guys the ammunition. let me just say this. When Lou Lamoriello was in New Jersey, they had a reputation for being a certain way. But the one thing I always liked was everybody was there when the room was open. Mm-hmm. They were a great team for a long time when I covered them. And Brodeur talked in the mornings, game days. All their great players, from Stevens to Niedermeyer to Brodeur, Bobby Holik, like, they were all there. Now, you did it on their schedule, but they were there. And I always found that that was an organization that had a reputation of being one way, and things were different. Now, I wasn't there day to day, and maybe it was different for those who were, and I will always concede that. But for a team that had a reputation for being very difficult, and in some ways they were, like they didn't promote their players and things like that, mm-hmm. from a pure media point of view, they were always phenomenal to deal with.
Who do you think some of the more progressive teams are out there as far as getting their talent out, getting their stories out, being proactive?
Well, I think they're all much better now. Like,
And is that just because there's different
social
platforms?
Social media, yeah. We want to be the carrier.
Everyone
has
a social media director. Everyone pushes out their own content.
You know what I'll say? People ask, like, what's it like to work in sports? And I say, it's like life. 95% of the people are great, and 5% of them are just asses that ruin it for everybody else, right? Mm. And I really found that. You know, I remember when I broke in covering the NBA, as some people who follow my career know, and I was a middle-class white Jewish kid from Toronto, and there was nobody in the NBA with the same background as me. They came from very different backgrounds. But I learned that if you were there almost every day and you treated people fairly and respectfully and you showed your face if you said something on the radio that they didn't like because they all heard about it, mm-hmm. it was the same. You know, the players would – and maybe I don't know that guy's name, but I know his face. He's here every day. He shows up. And it was just the same. And I find that in hockey too. If you're there, especially when you criticize somebody, if you're there mm-hmm. and you work, they know who works and they know who doesn't work.
I'm glad we got to the question about TV with Kevin. And I remember talking to John Shannon about this when he ran Leafs TV. And his point was always, look, the Toronto Maple Leafs own Leafs TV. We should be controlling the content. We should be controlling the information. Teams are starting to do that a lot more with their websites and their Twitter feeds and Instagram, etc. But John's big idea was, you know, when there's a trade, that should be the outlet to break it. Mm-hmm. You know, it shouldn't be Sportsnet, TSN, The Score, wherever that breaks a trade. It should be them. Do you start to see now the beginnings of teams more possessive?
Oh, yes. There's no question.
Of their
that.
Players and of their content. And no, we're doing something with PK today if you're Nashville. No, sorry, we're doing something with Claude Giroux for Philadelphia today. That avenue is closed.
You know what? I thought you were talking about breaking trades. Like, teams are
That too.
They try to be very protective of that, which is fine. Like, it's competition. I don't have a problem with that. You know, yes, I know that, and this is probably a question for some of our bosses, but I know at times they've been frustrated that that happens. I just think there's plenty to go around. I really do. You know, I think you have to be a good partner. And just because, say, Claude Giroux, the Flyers say we need Claude Giroux to do this one thing for us, and doesn't mean that we can't say, look, give us 5 dates that we want to do something with Claude Giroux. Let's make it work. I think there are plenty of ideas to go around. And the other thing, too, is I really believe in hockey. There is much more depth to these personalities than we show. Much more depth.
We talked about this a little bit last podcast,
yes,
too.
And the barrier, much more
and
depth.
The barriers that go up, and that's probably for another podcast as well. Want to get to some Ask 31 questions, but a couple more things from the 31 Thoughts piece at sportsnet.ca.
It's going to be a long one today.
It might be a little bit
long. I always shudder at the long ones.
Okay, hold on a second here. Thought number 4 on Jim Benning and the Sedins.
Yeah.
Futures for both.
You know, the Benning thing, as I mentioned, a few people tweeted me. We talked a couple weeks ago about a GM. We talked with Doug, who I knew was the family wasn't thrilled about what was going on. He wasn't thrilled about the effect it was having on his family. And a number of people from Vancouver tweeted at me. And one reporter actually texted me and said, were you talking about Benning? And no, I wasn't. But I know Benning has said that. It's weird to me. Like, Jeff, it just reads to me like Trevor Linden is supportive, but they're waiting to see what's out there. That's what it reads to me as. And the Sedins, you know, Chris Johnson reported about a week ago that, you know, they were thinking of coming back next year. But I think the team asked to know before the deadline. I don't think they're going to know. And I think the Canucks are kind of caught up in a lot of different theories right now. And we have to figure out which is the path they're going to take.
Can the Canucks move forward if they come back?
Yes. I don't.
You don't buy that one?
No, I don't.
They already have a new first line.
Doesn't matter. Like, they can be your third line if you want it to be.
Are they going to come back for that, though?
But you have to be honest and just say to them, guys, if you come back, this is the role. Like, there's a story I tell that one of my first TV interviews, I got told by someone that, A, he didn't like my voice, and B, I wasn't good looking enough to be on TV. Like, I know that's really hard to believe. It's impossible to believe, actually. But, you know, it hurt, but I really appreciated that they didn't BS me. They told me the truth. And I realized that if I wanted to be on TV, I better be a good reporter and a good makeup artist, because I wasn't getting there on my looks alone.
Good looks and shallow charisma, baby.
That's right. But, like, I would want someone to come to me, like, to go to the Sedins at the end of the year and say, Daniel Henrich, if you guys come back, it's going to be this. So nobody goes away angry. At least you can say, this is the way it's going to be. We'd love to have you back in this role. And those guys, if they want to come back to Vancouver, they'll go back in those roles, and they'll understand.
We have a lot of listeners from the Toronto area that tune in on Thought Number 5, talking about the 50 contracts,
yeah,
talking about Josh Levo, Matt Martin, perhaps done with the Maple Leafs organization, decisions on Shoshnikov. How do you see the Maple Leafs situation shaking out, knowing that Lou Lamoriello, Leafs general manager, does not want to go in the trade deadline at the max 50 contract?
I think Shoshnikov gets dealt for sure, simply because he can't stay in the minors on a conditioning stint forever, and he can't clear waivers anymore. And there is interest. I know the concussion scared some people, but there is interest in him, although apparently the Maple Leafs' asking price was a bit higher than some were expecting. Same with Levo. I think they've asked a bit more than some people were expecting, but I have no doubt that there's people who think he can play. Matt Martin's a bit of a different one. I think he's very frustrated, prideful veteran. I think Toronto is looking. They're going to have to keep money. He's got two more years under contract. But I am curious to see if the Islanders would consider that, Toronto took a bit of the money.
Was really interested to see the name Brandon Saad pop up, specifically considering how much Chicago ended up paying to
You're not
to
the first person
Saad.
Who said that to me.
That was the one, and I got this, by the way. I get the 31 thoughts from Elliot Friedman today. Was it 5:30 this morning, 5:45? Maybe it was even a little bit earlier.
It was a little earlier than that. It was a long night.
Holy smokes.
And I had to be up at 6:30 too, so it was...
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
But I'm the 5:30 guy, so I get like, whoa, okay. And then I get down to number 11 as I'm reading this over my coffee, and I'm like, Brandon Saad?
Here's the thing. He's... was demoted to the third line last weekend.
I think it was four.
Well, last night. I think you, yeah, you know, I watched
Calgary.
The
there
game.
Were, there were shifts.
You
he's
could
on the
argue
line.
Whether or not he was on the third line or the fourth line, and you know, I just think if you're Chicago now, you know, you're going to get ripped for making that deal, but you just got to do what you have to do. Like, I don't know if that's a deal that gets made now, but I think they're looking and saying.
Is that not a real tough one, though, for Stan Bowman to make? Like, you can understand if a new general manager comes in, then it's, you know, gloves off and you can do that deal.
Like, we all worry about perception, right? And I know there's the buzzards are flying over Chicago right now. I've always been a believer in if you make a mistake, don't compound the mistake. If it doesn't work, find a solution. You know, maybe it still works, but it's not working right now. And the Blackhawks have to find some way of unlocking cap room.
Maybe I just... too much in love with the hometown story, but is Pittsburgh a fit there?
You know, I've wondered about that, but they don't have – their cap situation is not easy either. Like, to me, that's the most logical thing. Like, it depends on how they make it work cap-wise.
I'm doing this off the top of my head. Didn't they pass over Saad to grab Joe Morrow in that draft? Or is it Pouliot?
I'd have to remember.
Don't do these things off the top of your head, Merrick.
You know, the other thing, too, is that, you know, Hornqvist comes off the cap, although, you know, he's been a really good player for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious. I mean, that's the most logical one, but I'd be lying if I told you I knew it was going to be.
Did you see Hornqvist last Friday pulling the nickel and dime Sean Avery move in front of Braden Holtby, putting his hand up in front of his face to try to screen a shot? Honestly, Elliot, I don't know why more players don't do that. Avery turned his back, and I get that, and that's one thing. But just stand there and put your hand in the face.
The first time I saw it, I just laughed because it's so
Hornqvist
weird.
Move?
You just
laugh.
And plus, that guy's pretty funny. But if we saw that every night, we'd hate it.
Some guys would be getting chopped down.
Yes.
If we saw it every single night. Speaking of Pittsburgh Penguins, I don't think this is a surprise. We've always sideways joked about this all season long, but the odds of Matt Cullen returning to, I'm not just going to say Pittsburgh, but returning to the Jim Rutherford mix, I don't think would shock anybody.
No, I just think that Matt Cullen, he was scratched the other day in Minnesota, and I don't think that's necessarily a big deal. He is 40 years old. He's going to miss games. You know what? Honestly, Jeff, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the guy they go out and get.
All right, let's get to some Ask 31s here and wrap up the podcast. Thanks for sticking with us so long today. This comes from Christian Krupa. Can you guys do a weekly segment of trades or draft stories? Doesn't have to be huge names. Enjoy hearing that so much, and you're killing it. So more stuff on trades that didn't happen, drafts. You know what we should do? Just leading up to trade deadline. I mean, I've got a list of them. I'm sure you do as well. Just the greatest trades that never happened.
Yeah.
Just a whole list of this was
like
close.
Josh McDaniels to McDaniel to the Indianapolis Colts.
And then now the feud is on.
Yes. What did they say today? The rivalry is back.
The rivalry is back.
That's good.
Just do something. We'll do that in advance of trade deadline. That's a good one.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head of deals that, you know what, I have to prepare for that one better. But we will do that. I'll come up with some that I know we're close.
That'll be our trade deadline.
That's our homework assignment for next week.
Yeah, thanks, Christian. Appreciate that. Now we have to think. From Edward L. Oh, great Twitter name, too. @66Hosang66. Islanders fan.
Yeah.
What,
I wonder how he feels about Hosang being in Bridgeport.
What D-man is Gar Snow going to trade for since Mayfield is now out 4 weeks?
It's getting worse for the Islanders, man. Oof. I mean, Holden, but are the Islanders and the Rangers going to help each other?
Well, it's like saying, listen, Jack Johnson, but is Columbus going to hand over Jack Johnson to the Islanders?
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying to think, like, who's...
Mike Green?
Yeah, I wonder, Garth doesn't like to pay a lot for rentals, I don't think.
This is a unique situation.
It is a unique situation. I got to tell you, somebody said to me this week, you have assumed the whole way through that if they don't make the playoffs, he's going to leave. Somebody said to me that they thought that Tavares is so loyal, it doesn't necessarily mean that. Like, I don't know what to believe anymore, but it made me think. This is a guy with decent contacts.
There is a lot placed on the loyalty of John Tavares. We always try to put ourselves in that situation. I think that's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that I would act the same way that John Tavares is about to act.
No. Okay, so who's out there? You know what? I'll tell you this. One guy, and I'm not convinced he's available, but one guy, if he's available, there will be like a mad rush to get him, is Hjalmarsson from Arizona. But I'm not convinced they're going to trade him.
One of the best shot suppression defensemen in the game, period.
And guy's been on a winner. I mean, his body has taken a lot of abuse. I'm not convinced Arizona's doing that, but if they did, I think the lineup on him would be very, very long.
Deborah Stanish, everyone agrees that Jagr's NHL career ended on a whimper rather than a bang. What are some of the best and worst NHL exits? Well, the best is Andrejczyk. You leave winning the Stanley Cup.
Well, I always remember Dallas Drake. He was another guy. He retired and won the Stanley Cup in Detroit. I remember him like just bawling on the ice. Like that was really something special to see. Like guys who like lose it on the ice and then that's it. Like, I remember Dallas Drake doing that. And that one stuck out for me because I was on the ice when that happened. That's a great one, too, Andrejczyk.
To me, the worst ones are always the ones that don't end on your own terms.
Well, Doug Gilmore.
That's right. Yeah, who did he get backed into? Is it
Dave Lowry. I covered that game.
Calgary.
He gets retired. He gets reacquired by Toronto. That's right. All that
was
thing.
Was it the first game?
Yeah,
neutral
first shift.
Zone. Yeah, that's right.
One shift.
Backed into. Oh, boy.
One shift. That one was a tough one to watch. I was covering that game. The guys who get hurt. That's the toughest one. Guys who want to get signed and don't get signed. But Gilmore is the one that, and the thing is, at least he had a great post-career, but that was one I remember because I was right there when it happened.
Always wanted to see because it would be a great visual. They do this in amateur wrestling. I think they do this in weightlifting too. When it's your last event and you've done your last lift or competed in your last match, you take your shoes off and you leave them in the center of the ring and you walk out.
That's pretty cool.
Would love to see an NHLer do that. Just take off the skates, leave them at center ice, and walk off the ice. The
visual
of that would be, Elliot, fantastic. From Yuri Motruk Sr., who do you think the LA Kings will target for trade deadline?
You know, I think they've looked at Pacioretty. I think the price is too high for them. Ultimately, I think Jeff Carter's coming back, and I believe, and that's probably as good as they can do. Yeah. You know, I know they've talked to Ottawa about Phaneuf, but I don't see the match. You know, for one thing, Ottawa's going to have to eat a lot of money there. And for another, they'd probably have to take a contract that, you know, the Kings wouldn't want. But I don't see that. You know, I think those are the kinds of guys the Kings are going to look at.
Let's finish the podcast on this one. Andrew Evans submits, would the Hockey Hall of Fame ever consider announcing their inductees at the NHL Awards similar to how the NFL does it? You know, that's always kind of, I've always looked at that little, because it comes out in a press release.
Well, here's why I would say no. Not because it isn't a good idea. It is a very good idea. But for one thing, the Hall of Fame has a deal with a competing broadcaster. And I'm sure the competing broadcaster, we air the awards and the competing broadcaster does not. So I'm sure they want their day. They pump a lot of money into the Hockey Hall of Fame. And number two.
But why not make it then a TV special?
I think they do now. I think they kind of do that. They show all the calls and stuff like that of people.
Like live.
Not live. I think they tape it and package it. But it's close.
Sure.
One thing I've learned is people want their day. Okay? Now, for example, the All-Star Game. A lot of people hate the All-Star Game. They say, why don't you get rid of it? Or why don't you make the All-Star Game an outdoor game, since outdoor games aren't real hockey anyway? And I learned, as I go through the business of sports, wait a sec, you might not like the All-Star Game. But that doesn't mean that somebody in the NHL doesn't want it. They want their day to be to say, we host All-Star.
Look what Kevin said the NHL, the All-Star game did for Nashville.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, too, is that if you combine the All-Star game with an outdoor game, you lose the revenue from having the other thing. Yeah. So everybody wants their day, their standalone day. And even though that's an excellent idea, it's not going to happen because the Hall wants its day.
So why does the NFL do it that way?
I wonder if it's because they don't have the same setup.
One of the dates now that I circle on the calendar, and it's been so fantastic, whether it was, you know, the Connor McDavid reveal, where he's going, but draft lottery day.
It's the best.
It's fantastic.
It's the biggest day of the year.
It's so good, Elliot. Mm-hmm. It is fantastic.
Yeah.
Love the way, biased here because it's our group that does it, but love the way it's done, love the way it comes off, love the drama about it, love all the general managers in the seats and trying to read, you know, okay, who's going to get the first pick based on where the floor director put which general manager. You know,
no, I don't think that you're looking for too much there. I see them do that setup, but it's not that simple.
Okay, because I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay, hang on. So, man, this guy can get a quick exit. So, the floor managers put this guy there. And
the question,
I'm overthinking it?
Yes, you're really overthinking it. Okay. Because I've seen the setup. It's done early. The biggest question is, who damaged the green room the most?
Who damaged the green room the most?
Because the way, for people who aren't familiar with this, each team brings two kinds of representatives.
Yeah.
There's one who sits in that studio in front of the camera,
and there's
one who's locked in the room with the machines. And, you know, suffice to say it, I think the results in the past have led to some damage.
I would imagine that the McDavid draft would have led to some damage.
Yes, and I think the Matthews one did too.
Based on
a team that was hoping it would finish higher than it did.
Not just we didn't get it, but why does it have to be them?
I don't even think it was them.
Okay.
I think it was we didn't get it.
Gotcha.
That made everybody else sick.
We are all across North America. On that, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us on the 31 Thoughts podcast. Read Elliot's piece at sportsnet.ca. Thanks for the tip on doing the greatest trades that never happened. We'll do that as a draft preview podcast. And parting thoughts. Last thing to add. Motivational thoughts from Elliot Friedman.
We've been talking a long time today. Thank you for listening.
We're all out of words. Goodbye now.